I'm Jim Terrell, and I'm exploring the diversity of viewpoints about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Of special interest are individuals and groups with a nonviolent approach, cooperative projects in which Israelis and Palestinians work together for common goals, and the development of civil society. Dr. Ilan Pappe is a senior lecturer in the Political Science Department at Haifa University. He's also the academic director of the Research Institute for Peace at Givat Haviva. Givat Haviva is the educational center of Kibbutz Artzi, which fosters educational initiatives, research, community work in peace, democracy, coexistence, tolerance, social solidarity. Dr. Pape's recent books include The Making of the Arab-Israeli Conflict, 1948 to 1951, and, more recently, The Israel-Palestine Question. He spoke to me by phone from Haifa.
Is it accurate to say that you're one of the new historians?
Absolutely, that's true.
There's a word that's involved in that is a really touchy one here, and I gather from what I've been reading of your articles and stuff that it's touchy there. It's the word revisionism.
That's right. It's not so much touchy as it is a bit confusing in the local scene, because on the local scene in Israel, the revisionists are Menachem Begin's party. This was the right-wing party during the pre-state era.
Oh, I see.
And they were called the revisionists. And therefore, people get confused when you talk in Israel about revisionist historians. They may think that you want to represent the point of view of the right wing, whereas this is why we never opted for revisionism rather than the new history, just to make sure that people understand that actually we come from the other side of the political spectrum,
right,
which is, in Israeli terms, from the left, that is to say, more from the peace camp and not from the greater Israel camp. Which
right.
This is on a local scene, the two terms can be, it's a confusing term.
In North America, it's a confusing term because revisionist historians are people who deny the Holocaust.
The Holocaust, I know. I was once in a company of several historians in Athens who came from all over the world, and it was clear that there were two kinds of revisionist historians. Those who looked at the mirror and said, we were much more beautiful and honest and good than people tell about us. These were the French and the German. And there were those, like myself, who said, we were much worse than we were told. And this is much more like the Israeli revisionism.
Right.
So it's really, the message is much more important than the title, I would say, in this case.
You use that image of the mirror in several places.
A lot. Because I'm also an educator. I'm not just an historian. And I talk a lot to people who, you know, in schools, to teachers and students. And I understand that I'm facing an indoctrinating system that has shown the people a certain mirror that I'm trying to break, because I think what they're seeing is not what really happened, and that's very important for me.
Well, we'll come back to that a little later on.
Okay, that's right.
And I will call you a new historian. I think I'll avoid the quagmire of revisionism.
All right.
You say at one point that no true reconciliation between Israelis and Palestinians can ever take place without full awareness of what happened in the Nakba.
That's true.
Could you explain for our listeners what the Nakba is and why you say what you say about it?
Yes. I think the Nakba, in putting it in other terms, today we would call it ethnic cleansing. And ethnic cleansing means actually a mass expulsion of indigenous people from their own homeland by another people. So this is an act on a colossal level, almost a war crime, one could say, on a colossal level, that affected almost everyone in the Palestinian community. And any attempt to create a new reality in Israel and in Palestine cannot be done without acknowledging the fact that this had happened in 1948 and without discussing the implication of that act. And there are several ways of discussing implications of such collective crimes. We know that Desmond Tutu has taken South Africa in one direction, I think in a very positive direction, through his Truce Committee. And we know that in Rwanda and other places in Africa, people were going the wrong way about it, through retribution and revenge. So I'm not suggesting that. But what I'm saying is that such a collective trauma of the Palestinian victim that is still denied in Israel, still not acknowledged in Israel, repressed, is something that the Israelis would have to face, would have to reconcile with before any practical arrangement of how life together in 2002 could be arranged. And all the peace efforts since 1948, and I'm sorry to say that, also the peace efforts that were coached by the Americans, totally ignored that fateful event of 1948, which is such a formative event in the life of both Israelis and Palestinians. It's almost, and with this I'll end this intervention, it's almost as if Israelis and Germans today would sort of reconsider their relationship without acknowledging the Holocaust.
Uh-huh. That's an interesting comparison. Takes us back to that revisionism question.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
I'm not comparing between ethnic cleansing and genocide. Genocide is far worse.
Uh-huh.
But I'm comparing a traumatic collective event that one people perpetrated against the other and does not acknowledge.
So
it's not the only case in history, by the way, that people deny the ugliest chapters in their history. But these chapters are like demons in a cupboard. You know, they come back to you. You cannot really get rid of them if you don't deal with them.
I understand that completely. I was going to talk to you about this later, but that's a card maybe I should put on the table. It's a question that I really want to ask. On a personal level, I was born in the United States, and I found refuge in Canada during the Vietnam War. So I've come to see what I think are similarities in the history of the U.S. In its relation to its own indigenous people. And
in a similar way, by the way, if I may, I'm sorry, I didn't want to.
Please go ahead. No, go ahead.
No, I just thought about one of the things that was an eye-opener for me when I started researching 1948. I mean, apart from the fact that I realized that I was never told the story of 1948 in school, in the university, in my family, that I really had to reveal it myself. Of course, Palestinians knew that story all the time, but I was told to believe that this is sheer propaganda. One of the things I started revealing is how easily Israelis were using Arab names for villages they have eliminated and destroyed. And it reminds me in America how certain weapons have Native American names, like the Apache and the Tomahawk, which is a kind of a cynical reminder, if you want, of something that was there and was wiped out by force. And nobody acknowledges, but you have, nonetheless, you don't acknowledge it for many years, but you do acknowledge it by giving these terrible weapons the names of tribes that had been destroyed. But I'm not an expert in American history, so I shouldn't go too far into it.
Well, I'm certainly no expert on American history either, but my experience of American history is similar to what you describe with Israeli history. I certainly wasn't taught the kind of ethnic cleansing or even I think genocide in some cases. There were certainly whole tribes of people who were simply wiped right out, right off the face of the map. Today, people say, well, I didn't do it. I wasn't there. I wasn't responsible for that. And certainly I wasn't myself. But it's hard to deny that where we stand now is a place that would be different if those events hadn't occurred, and that there are feelings on the part of those people that need to be addressed. You can't turn back the clock. We can only speculate about what might have been, but the question that I would like to put to you as a political scientist and as a human being is where do we go from here?
Yeah. Well, I think first of all we go through the process of acknowledging. And for me it's a formidable task, which I find very difficult to convince my own society. I say first and foremost acknowledge what has been done and especially what you have done. Secondly, it might be worth your while to say you're sorry for what you have done. Mm-hmm. You might apologize for that. In various ways of apologies. There can be a symbolic act, there can be a compensation involved, there can be a willingness to include, as they do now in South Africa, to include in the textbook and the curricula what has happened. And then you are absolutely entitled to say to the other side, all right, now let's talk about practical implications. Bygones, in many ways, are bygones. As you say, you cannot bring the clock backwards. You cannot, it's inhuman now to throw out from the houses the people who inhabited them after the original people had been thrown out from there.
Right.
And I don't even know one Palestinian, by the way, who demands it. But after the acknowledgement and after the apology, I think there is a possibility to start talking about what political structures can be best, would be the best to serve the interests of both people. How would be, what would be a practical and reasonable and honorable solution to the question of refugees? Who should rule Jerusalem? In what way? But I think what we have done throughout the years of negotiations in the history of the Arab-Israeli conflict, that because the Israelis refused to go through that preliminary stage, the Palestinians felt that whenever they are signing an agreement about where the soldiers would be, what would be exactly the Palestinian state, what part of Jerusalem would be Palestinian, that they are forgetting something. And this is exactly what happened in Camp David in the summer of 2000, when Ehud Barak took together all these arrangements, which were done with totally disregard for the Nakba and what happened in 1948, and said to President Yasser Arafat, and now you should sign just another document. And that document says that you declare the end of the conflict. Namely, i.e., you have no more demands from the Israelis. But the basic Palestinian demand from the Israelis is that they would acknowledge that they are the victims of Zionism in 1948. They are the victims of an ethnic cleansing. And this is why the whole peace process collapsed in one day. And instead of peace, we had war, and so we still have this war going on.
So this is more of an answer to the phrase that is used all the time here. It's almost like a bumper sticker, is Barak's generous offer. You're saying that the reason that the generous offer was not a generous offer was that it failed to recognize the Nakba in the first place. Is that right?
It's part of it. And what was in, let's say that if the Israelis were very sophisticated, at least they should have offered a quid pro quo. They should have offered something that should replace the Palestinian demand for acknowledging the Nakba. What was on offer in Camp David? In Camp David, Ehud Barak offered a small Palestinian state without full sovereignty, without independent economic and foreign policy, with most of the Jewish settlements in the West Bank intact, and without any significant Palestinian sovereignty in Jerusalem. And this little Bantustan, this little protectorate, this little mini-state, without real sovereignty, almost a stateless state, was supposed to be the end of the Palestinian struggle. This would be the goal that should satisfy Palestinians for not making any further demands upon the Israelis, together with the fact that there was no mentioning and no reference to the major grievances of the Palestinians ever since 1948. This was an Israeli mythology that Barak made the most generous offer to the Palestinians in Camp David, and they rejected it. This is a mythology. This was not a generous offer. This was a dictate that suggested to the Palestinians that this is the best they can get because of the balance of power. The balance of power does not always dictate workable arrangements. because the balance of power today is not necessarily the balance of power tomorrow. And the weak sometimes have, as we know from the unfortunate suicide bombs, the weak side, the weaker party, sometimes have weapons that ridicule the power of the stronger party, in this case nuclear capability, because nuclear capability doesn't help human suicide, in the war against human suicide, as we know. So this whole notion that you can sort of manipulate the Palestinians into a position where they would be shown as the warmongers, the rejectionists, was based on the balance of power, first and foremost. We are the stronger party, the Israelis. They would have to accept our dictate. And secondly, on the notion that you can really settle this bloody conflict, very charged conflict, without referring to the most formative year and to the most basic issue which lies at the heart of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict.
So we're back at the Nakba. This is Jim Terrell at Kootenai Co-op Radio in Nelson, British Columbia. I've been talking to Dr. Ilan Pappe from the University of Haifa in Israel.